This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The flood. We have major flooding happening at this hour in and around Calgary. From Camore to Coleman, communities are battling rising waters. In Calgary, it could be the biggest flood since 2005.
In Canada, an extreme rainfall event, made worse by a stalled weather system, probably powered by an unstable Arctic and climate change, has closed down the country's oil-trading capital. In Calgary, nature accomplished what politics could not. The largest oil company headquarters, including Suncor Energy, Imperial Oil, and Shell, saw their head offices closed as downtown Calgary was evacuated and left without power for days. Trading in Canadian crude oil stopped. Alberta towns more than 100 years old were evacuated, flooded, and wrecked. At least 75,000 people in the major oil trading capital of Calgary were ordered out of their homes. Most of them do not have any flood insurance. Overland insurance is no longer sold in Canada following the previous record flood of 2005. Billions of dollars of damage to homes, businesses, roads, bridges, and all kinds of infrastructure occurred. The Trans-Canada Highway connecting to the West Coast was shut down for days. The oil promoter-in-chief, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, flew to his hometown of Calgary, clearly shocked that climate change could affect Alberta itself. Sure, some South Pacific islands may flood, but Alberta? I've seen a little bit of flooding in Calgary before, he said. I don't think any of us have seen anything like this. Perhaps if Harper had not shut down climate research facilities, particularly in the Arctic, and muzzled Canadian climate scientists, he might have heard about research from Rutgers University showing jet stream patterns were stalling due to melting Arctic ice and climate change. The premier of the Canadian province of Alberta, Alison Redford, flew back from New York, where she was promoting the Keystone XL pipeline to ship polluting tar sands oil to the United States. She, too, was shocked, shocked, I tell you, at the devastation. Who could have guessed an overheated atmosphere could hold so much water? Canadian television anchors and reporters were unable to utter the words climate change or extreme precipitation event, this even as similar floods hit Europe and India. The CTV network reported the strange blocking high, heating eastern Canada with summer while keeping a swirl of storms and extreme rain in the west. The stalled jet stream appeared on the map without any explanation. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, telling it like it is. Later we'll hear one brief radio clip, the only major media report I can find anywhere, telling Canadians the real cause of the weird weather that strikes again and again now as the new normal. But first, let's get back to basic solutions for right living. Those are the answers. We'll start with my interview with one of North America's pioneers of a brand new method of clean food production, food you'll want to eat, and it's called aquaponics. It has just arrived in North America. I predict within 10 years you will be buying organic local produce and fresh fish from neighborhood fish and veggie operations, or maybe you will grow it all yourself in your own backyard. Sylvia Bernstein, author of Aquaponic Gardening, tells us how. Later we'll talk with the driving force behind the world's largest outlet for sustainable living, Brian Welch. He's the CEO of Ogden Publications, publisher of the Mother Earth News, the Utney Reader, and Grit. Brian explains his optimism in dark times and why we need that to change the world into the lives we really want. This is Radio EcoShock. We're in our mobile studio at the Mother Earth News Fair in Puyallup, Washington. And our guest is Sylvia Bernstein. She is a leader and I think I can say an expert on aquaponic gardening, and that is growing fish and plants together, although there's a lot of things we have to explore to find out what aquaponics really means. I'm particularly interested in it, as you'll find out. Let's welcome Sylvia to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
Okay, so we've got a bunch of people, they don't really know what aquaponics is. How would you explain it to them?
The short answer is that it's an ecosystem that's developed by combining hydroponics or soilless gardening with aquaculture or growing fish in captivity. And so you join those two together, bacteria being the joining force between the two, and you come up with aquaponics. So it's a completely organic, highly sustainable, low water way of growing both fish and plants.
Well, you know, it might interest you that my wife worked with the Great Bear Rainforest Campaign in British Columbia, and one of the things that they found out was that the fish, the salmon, the millions of salmon going up the streams, were actually fertilizing the forests. So there you have, in the grand scheme of nature, a big-scale experiment which we're bringing back into the farmstead, the homestead. Could you do this in your backyard even?
Oh, absolutely. And isn't it wonderful how we can look to nature and use biomimicry to actually create natural solutions based on what's already happening out there? You know, Mother Nature can teach us a lot. So people are growing in their backyards. Generally, if you don't have a year-round growing climate, you might want to put a greenhouse structure of some sort over it. Aquaponics is a year-round activity. You can't really shut it down like your dirt gardens because you do have the fish there that need a place to live all the time. But there are people that are growing using some cold water fish, trout, for example, or fish that can tolerate fairly cold waters, like a lot of our native fish. You've got catfish and bluegill, fish like that, that can actually, they're not going to eat anything, but they'll certainly survive colder water. But it's a lot more fun to be able to grow year-round, and so I recommend a greenhouse for that. But there's also people that are growing indoors. So they're growing in garages and in basements. We've got a guy close to us that has his aquaponics fish tank in his basement, and he's put grow beds in his laundry room, and he pumps the water back and forth through the laundry chute, which I just think is wonderful because his laundry room is right off his kitchen. So he goes right in there to pick his herbs and produce, and then the fish are kept nice and cool down in the basement.
I've thought about doing that, and I was going to ask you about that. My major concern was, what about the odor? Is it going to be a smell problem if you've got these inside the house?
No. A healthy aquaponics system has no odor at all, except for perhaps you get this kind of nice spring earth smell from the planting beds. It's really wonderful. But there's no fish smell at all. The smell from fish actually comes from rotting fish flesh. You know, fish itself don't create any odor. And even the solid waste, nice way of saying the poop from the fish, has no odor to it whatsoever. So it's a very odor-free system.
One of the reasons this interests me is I'm mainly a vegetarian myself, but I do like to eat fish. I think it's a good brain food. I think it's a clean food. It doesn't have all the chemicals and the hormones that you find in so much other meat today. And I think it's easy to digest. So it seems to make sense from that point of view. Are you hearing from people who want to get into aquaponics because of that?
Absolutely. And I'm the same way, by the way. There's a term for us. We're called pescatarians. We are fish-eating vegetarians. And there's a lot of people that want to eat that way. They want to avoid meat and chicken and some of the things that come along with that. So, yeah, this is a terrific way to eat. It's completely organic. When you think about it, the fish in an aquaponic system are actually the organic certifying agency, right? I can't be using pesticides in my system because it's going to hurt my fish. And I can't be using hormones and medication and antibiotics on my fish because it would actually hurt my plants. So because I've got to be concerned about both of those entities and frankly the bacteria as well, I have to be very, very careful about anything that I put into my system. And so it forces an organic discipline, which I really like. The other thing is that aquaponics uses very little water. Some say less than 10% of soil gardening, traditional soil-based gardening, because you don't have this seepage in through the ground. All the water in an aquaponic system is recirculated through the system. And unlike hydroponic systems where you have to actually dump the chemical nutrients that the plants are grown in because it gets out of balance and you've got to sort of reset the system every few weeks, in an aquaponic system, you never, ever do that. You wouldn't get rid of the water because that's where all my wonderful nutrients and bacteria are. So we use very little water in an aquaponic system, which I think is going to become more and more important as global climate change is occurring and water, particularly in areas like where I am, I'm in Colorado, and in the Southwest, water is becoming more and more important in what we're doing. It's always been very important, but it's a critical issue now. We're facing more and more drought. And I think that using less water to grow your produce is important.
Absolutely. I've done shows on Colorado and the water system and also how much fracking is using up of the waters there. That's another whole story. Don't get me going on that rant. It's a real battle there. Now, we talked about the types of fish that you can raise, and one of the most popular further south, at least, is tilapia because they reproduce so quickly. I was wondering, could people use solar power to heat up the water? There's new types of solar power where you can heat water even in the wintertime. They don't have to freeze up. You can keep them going. Have you heard of people experimenting with that, trying to keep their fish warm enough? What do they have to be, about 80 degrees or something? What's the temperature?
For tilapia or your more tropical fish, and frankly, even some other fish, catfish, bluegill that I had named before, are going to produce the most waste, eat the most, and grow the fastest in your warmer temperatures as well. Really, it doesn't have to be 80s. In the 70s, they're perfectly happy to. During the winter, honestly, I keep my tilapia at about 68. That's where they are when I go in the morning. And what I've discovered is that they'll start eating at 68 degrees. So it's not really as severe as you would think it would be. To your question about using alternative energy to heat the water, absolutely. There's a very strong renewable energy and off-grid and DIY movement within aquaponics that this is, because it's a sustainable technology, we really need to continue along that continuum and get off the grid for our power sources. So people are using geothermal, and they're using heated water flow through heat exchangers, pellet stoves, solar heating components. So it's very much a part of what we do. I actually run a large community site online called the Aquaponic Gardening Community. And every day there's lots of discussions going on about how do we get off grid. So yeah, it's very important to what we're doing.
What's that website?
Aquaponicscommunity.com.
Aquaponicscommunity.com.
You can also get to it off of our website, which is theaquaponicsource.com.
Well, I should have told listeners, you're a leader and an organizer in this whole movement. Can you tell us about some of the organizations involved here?
Oh, you bet. And one that I'm particularly proud of is the Aquaponics Association, which was just founded a little over 2 years ago with the very first Aquaponics Association conference. And it's the first time that aquapons, as we refer to ourselves, in North America have ever really gotten together physically. You know, not there's a few different forums out there where people are conversing around the world all the time, which have been very important to the development of aquaponics. But it was really one of the first times that people have physically gotten together. And there's no replacement for just being, you know, face to face with people, just like here at the Mother Earth News Fair, and meeting other leaders and movers and shakers in the industry. So the Aquaponics Association was sort of founded out of that first conference in Orlando, Florida, 2.5 years ago. And now I think it's approaching about 500 members, and its goal is to promote aquaponics around the country.
It's a pretty new field, isn't it? I don't remember hearing about aquaponics in the 70s.
Yeah, it's ironic because it's, when you think about it, I mean, you gave a perfect example with your wife and the salmon. Aquaponics, in some senses, has been around since life on Earth. It's this notion of fish fertilizing the environment around it, especially if you look at flooding and all of that. But man-made aquaponics, you could say the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were man-made aquaponics. But then if you sort of continue the thinking a little bit further and say, well, if aquaponics is a constructed ecosystem created for the purpose of growing fish and plants together, A lot of that research really only started taking place about 30 years ago, which if you look at various disciplines out there, that's pretty recently. And that was advanced a lot by the work of a man named Dr. James Rakosi at the University of the Virgin Islands. Dr. Rakosi was an aquaculture guy who was looking into ways to use plants to filter fish water. You know, waste in a contained aquaculture system is a big problem. So he took on with his studies, how is it that I use this waste for a beneficial purpose? And aquaculturalists had been playing around with different water plants for a while. But what Dr. Rakosi did that was kind of unique was he decided, well, I don't have to grow water hyacinth. Why don't I grow lettuce and tomatoes and okra and start growing food that people can actually eat? And so he advanced that a lot over his 30-year career. And he's given a lot of credit for that, rightfully so. He's recently retired. In the meantime, though, so that was sort of the commercial farming aspect of aquaponics. In the meantime, there was work that was happening more at a grassroots level. A lot of that was in Australia around home and backyard aquaponic gardening. And that was more focused on using gravel and creating growing beds in more simplified systems. What Dr. Rakosi was doing was called deep water culture, raft-based for bigger production. But with these guys in Australia, actually working off of the work of a couple here in Missouri, but they really took this notion, you know, leaps and bounds further along with backyard aquaponics. And a lot of that happened in the early turn of the century, so around 2001 through present time. So the big popularity of aquaponics really started happening in Australia in the beginning of the 2000s, and then it sort of moved to the United States only in about the past 3 or 4 years. If you look at things like, if you've ever seen Google Trends, where you can see how often something is trending, you look at right about around 2009-10, all of a sudden the number of people that were interested in, if you use searching on Google as a proximity for being interested in it, really took off right around that time. And a lot of that had to do with, that's when the community site got started. That's when my book came out. There really hadn't been a book that was widely available on aquaponics to sort of take people through it until that time. And people started talking, and that's when it's really taken off.
And what is the title of your book?
Aquaponic Gardening, a step-by-step guide to growing fish and vegetables together.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Sylvia Bernstein. We're talking about aquaponics, obviously. You know, I looked through a lot of YouTube videos trying to educate myself about this to see whether I could get involved with it. And I found such a diverse group of people involved. There were people from the deep south with the big drawl, and there were people trying it up in northern basements, as you say. A lot of them seemed to be cutting apart these food containers, I guess you would call them, big plastic crates of some kind, and welding them and making their own tanks. Could you tell us about how you can get started cheap and give it a try?
You bet. And aquaponics really lends itself towards using a lot of recycled materials as well. I think what you're probably describing is called an IBC tote, IBC standing for Intermediate Bulk Container. And those are used for shipping liquids all around the country, the world. And they lend themselves really nicely to aquaponic systems. You can take a whole one and create a 275-gallon fish tank out of it. You can cut it in half and create a couple grow beds out of it. So IBC totes are used a lot. You just have to, I'll caution your listeners, you have to be very careful about what used to be stored in your IBC tote. One of the things we pay a lot of attention to in aquaponics is the pH of the solution. And I had a guy call me once and say that he couldn't get his pH under control. It was always really low. And I started asking him about his system and found out that he was using IBC totes that used to carry battery acid in them. So, you know, that just was never going to be a real good situation. And you're growing your food in it. You're growing animals in it. You want to make sure that it held something that's going to be compatible with that. But IBC totes work great. Blue plastic storage barrels work great. Cut those in half and you've got both sides of a grow bed. People have used bathtubs. Lots of recycled materials can be used. And I think that's probably the least expensive way. There's certainly pros and cons to doing that. It's a terrific to be pulling these things out of the landfill for sure. You do have the issue with needing to be real sure of what was in that container before you use it. And depending on how important aesthetics are to what you're building, it's going to be a little harder to get a real nice look out of a blue plastic storage barrel, but it can be done. And it's a great way to get started, for sure.
Well, you might end up with more fish than you can eat. And I think people have been bartering and trading and selling fish since Neolithic times. So it must lend itself, again, to spreading out a little bit in the community if you have a successful operation.
Definitely. And especially, as you mentioned before, if you're growing something like a tilapia, that obviously, assuming that you get male-female and not all male fish, then you're going to have lots and lots of babies, and you could become a real popular guy in the neighborhood if you're giving away your tilapia babies to your friends that have their aquaponic systems. But even if you don't, you can't use all of those fish, frankly, with the babies, if you just leave them in the tank, the other fish will consume, I'm looking for nice words here, will consume the babies as a snack. I've heard of people that have chickens that have actually fed the tilapia fingerlings to the chickens, and they're great. There are lots of ways, especially in a homesteading environment, that you can utilize these extra babies that you might not want to use.
And I guess you can also obviously dry, freeze, do whatever with the fish and keep it for when you're ready to eat it.
Yes, yes. Well, and understand that when you're growing up the fish, some, just like in any animal population, some will be more aggressive than others. They'll get more food. They'll grow more quickly. And so what you'll end up with is, let's say you get 50 male-female tilapia that you're growing in your IBC tote. Over time, what you're going to find is that only some percentage of those are going to be available to be plate size, about 12 inches. And then you pull those out and eat them, and then the next group will grow up. And so they don't all end up ready to eat at the same time. I have found that we have an outdoor system that we start up in the spring, and I've got to either harvest or bring my fish in into the greenhouse at the end of the summer. And I did find 2 years ago that it was easier just to harvest all of them. And we froze them, and they ended up being great. Thanksgiving dinner was when we pulled out a lot of them, so out of the freezer.
We've been talking about fish because they're really fascinating, but there is the whole other side of this, which is the plants that you're growing and how well they do with this system. And I think people have to understand, from what I've seen anyway, that the plant roots are not always in water and they're not always out of water. There's a balance happening there, how the nutrients get to them. And I've seen some fantastic results, people growing with aquaponics. Talk to us about the plant side of it.
You know, I agree 100%, and we get really fantastic results. Because the plants are, as you said, the roots aren't always submerged in water, assuming that you're using a media-based system and not a deep water culture or raft-based system. Because in a deep water culture system, plant roots are in water all the time. But a media-based system is usually done using what's called flood and drain. And so the water floods up the roots, and then it gets drained back down again. And in doing this, you end up having a lot of oxygen in the media environment for the plants. That, combined with getting enough water whenever they want it and the food is abundant, means that the plants don't have to focus a lot of their energy on their root system. When you think about what's happening in soil-based gardening, plants will develop a much more robust root system than they will in an aquaponic system, because they have to, in order to make sure that they get the nutrients and the water and the oxygen that they need. But because our plants in aquaponics don't need to develop quite as extensive of a root system, they can focus their energy on their top growth a lot more quickly. Because of that, we see faster rates of growth. it's just amazing how much growth you'll get out of an aquaponic system. Essentially, a media-based system will, within 3 to 6 months, really develop into essentially all the components of what you'd have in a really good organic soil. I put worms, composting red worms, in there. You've got animal solid waste. You've got lots of microbial life, fungi, and water and oxygen in abundance. And so because of this, we see terrific growth in these systems.
Right. They grow bigger and they grow faster. And I think the faster part is important if people are trying to feed themselves or others from these gardens. If you can cut down the time to where you can get the food, that's a good thing. Wrapping up here, why do you think this is becoming a wave of interest in America, and how big do you think it will get?
I think it's becoming a wave of interest for a few reasons. It has to do with food security and food sovereignty. Food security, very much because at least a lot of the people that I know, and I'm pretty sure I can bet that most of your audience, we're all very concerned about the source of our food. It feels sometimes like the government is not paying attention with the GMOs, with pesticide use, with just what's happening with big ag, that people want to take more control over their food. And in taking control of their food, then you can withstand a lot if you know that you always have a great source of organic, healthy food. And the other side of that is the notion of a great source of organic, healthy food. So much of the food that we're eating these days, we don't know the source of. And because of climate change, we can't always be sure about the future. I mean, worried. You know, I'm worried. And so with an aquaponic system, this really lets you set up your own food systems. So I think that's a huge driver in what's happening in aquaponics. But there are some other components to it, too. I think that, frankly, they're fun. You know, it's you've got the very serious side of taking control of your food, but you've also got a system it's a lot of fun to design and assemble these systems. I talk in my book about how I walk into my greenhouse in the morning, and it's alive. You've got water flowing all around the greenhouse. The fish are jumping up because they know that I'm the food cart here. And it's just a very alive function. You know, it's very different than my outdoor vegetable gardens. So there's a fun component there. It's a fantastic educational tool. So doing aquaponics with children, if you can imagine, you're not only teaching biology and chemistry, you're teaching the physics of water movement, of bell siphons siphoning off and on. If you're growing indoors, you've got the whole grow light thing with light spectrums and that happening. But the most important lesson is the notion of an integrated ecosystem, and the fact that in nature, reality is that if you tweak one part of an ecosystem, it's going to have an effect on all the rest of the ecosystem. And boy, when I went to school, I studied agricultural economics at UC Davis. We were taught that in agriculture and in my ag and soil science classes, basically formulas that if you want to increase your crop production by X amount, apply X amount of fertilizer to it. And that's how you increase your crop production. Not once do I remember there ever being a discussion, but here are the consequences of adding X amount of fertilizer and what you're doing to the groundwater and what you're doing to kill the microbial life in the soil. So this notion of consequences and complete ecosystems, I think, is really powerful for our children. And aquaponics teaches that in a very clear, visible way. And so I think all of these things are going to come together, and really aquaponics is going to take off because of that.
Do you have a blog or a website you want to tell us about?
I do. I write a blog every couple weeks called the Aquaponic Gardening Blog, but it's also on our website, theaquaponicsource.com. On our website, we have lots of free learning tools in there. We've got a whole FAQ section and some rules of thumb, and the community site is there where people can learn. And then we also have a store side. And on the store, we supply people with both what they need to build a system. We have some complete systems called our Aquabundance system. So if somebody isn't really a DIYer, because not everybody is, we will sell you a complete turnkey system. But we also have plumbing kits for if you've already got those IBC totes, but you don't really know how to put them together. We've got a line we call our Aquaparts plumbing kits. And then for somebody that really is more of a DIYer, but they're looking for specific parts, bulkheads, uni-seals, all that, we carry all that too. And then we've got a side we call running your system. So we can give you materials for taking your pH up and down, for testing. We sell live fish. We sell fish food, seed starting material, organic insect control, all that stuff. So you can find that on our site at theaquaponicsstore.com.
You are a busy person.
Try to stay out of trouble.
It's been great talking with you, Sylvia Bernstein, about aquaponics. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before we continue with our drive towards a sustainable world, let's take another quick moment to reflect on the dying path of fossil fuel destruction. Perhaps you've heard that Calgary, the oil capital of Canada, was more or less shut down by flash flooding and overflowing rivers. As fate would have it, I was in Calgary on the night of Wednesday, June 19th, as the black skies filled with thunder for almost a dozen hours. Sheets of rain, torrents of rain, more than I've seen, drenched the city. All the foothills let loose, creeks became rivers, rivers became fast-running lakes, filling the streets, the homes, entire neighborhoods, and towns. Fearing the water supply would become contaminated, there was panic buying of bottled water until the shelves ran dry. As always, few were ready for an extreme rainfall event in that dry prairie. Alberta is rich with the wealth from oil wells and the tar sands, but even that economy will reel from the billions of dollars of uninsured losses. The famous Calgary Stampede looked doubtful just 2 weeks away as major stadiums, parks, and the downtown core flooded. Apartment towers stood empty in the dark. The ruling party of Canada, the party of climate denial, the Conservatives, were due to convene their annual conference in Calgary the next week. That was postponed. Here is a brief clip from the government-supported Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the program Current Events, hosted by Anna Maria Tremonti. It's possibly the only report from a climate scientist in those days of nonstop coverage of the Alberta floods. The speaker is Robert Sandford, the EPCOR chair supporting the United Nations Water for Life decade.
Well, to scientists working in the domain of climate effects on water, this is really the worst of all possible outcomes. We built in floodplains because we thought we had relatively stable climate, the climate that we've experienced over the past century. We thought it would stay the same. We also thought that we had a good grasp of how variable we could expect climatic conditions to be based on what we've experienced in the past century. And now we've discovered that neither assumption was correct. We do not have adequate means to protect development in floodplains. Climatic conditions are more variable than we thought, and that variability is increasing as climate changes, and we've also discovered that our hydrologic conditions are changing.
So what do floods like this tell us about what's happening with our water cycles?
Well, if we put all of the data together, they tell us that warming temperatures are altering the form that water takes and where it goes in the hydrosphere. Evidence that increasing temperatures are accelerating the manner and rate at which water is moving through the hydrological cycle is now widely enough available to allow us to connect the dots with respect to what's happening in Canada. So let's start very briefly in the Canadian Arctic. In the north and throughout much of the Canadian boreal, water that's been trapped as ice in the form of glaciers and as permanent snowpack and permafrost is in decline. And the same sort of thing is visibly evident in Canada's western mountains. There's now evidence that we've lost as many as 300 glaciers in the Canadian Rockies alone between 1920 and 2005. And the same thing that's causing our glaciers to disappear is in combination with landscape change, changing precipitation patterns on the Great Plains. And the same warming is causing water left on the land after the last glaciation in the Great Lakes region to evaporate. So you might ask, well, where's all this water going? And one of the places it's going is into the atmosphere, where it becomes available to fuel more frequent and intense extreme weather events, such as the one that you had in Toronto in 2005 that caused $700 million worth of flood damage to infrastructure, roads, and homes. And you may remember that in that year, Calgary just dodged the same kind of bullet. Well, not this time. And what we're seeing here is that rising temperatures and the increasing concentration of atmospheric vapor are making what were once predictable natural events much worse. And what we've discovered is the atmosphere holds about 7% more water vapor for each temperature degree Celsius temperature increase. And what this tells us is the old math and the old methods of flood prediction and protection won't work anymore. And until we find a new way of substantiating appropriate action in the absence of this hydrologic stability, flood risks are going to be increasingly difficult to predict or to price, not just in Calgary or Canmore, but everywhere.
So you're saying then that there's more condensation in the air. Warm air can hang on to water longer and then burst when it hits somewhere that can no longer hang on to it?
Well, warmer atmosphere is more turbulent and it carries more water vapor, and we're seeing that happening widely. We're also seeing in North America a disruption in the jet stream, which is allowing climatic events to cluster and remain in places for longer periods of time, resulting in more intense and floods and droughts. And we're seeing this as a result of a general warming of the atmosphere.
That was Robert Sanford on CBC explaining the science behind extreme rainfall events due to climate change. Even he did not have the courage to suggest we must reduce our emissions of fossil fuels as a solution. He spoke instead of adapting to wilder climate swings. Enough. The same madness of denial goes on all over the world. In my opinion, all you and I can do as individuals who know that physics and nature will not be denied is to keep pushing the movement towards a sane, sustainable society. We're about to talk to an optimist driven by a vision that it can be done. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're at the Mother Earth News Fair with Brian Welch, who runs Ogden Publications, and it's the publisher of Mother Earth News and many other very interesting publications, some of which I'm sure you read. It's really a pleasure to welcome you, Brian, to our mobile studio here.
Thanks, Alex.
You know, the last time we talked, it was about your book, Beautiful and Abundant, Building the World We Want. And we didn't really come to an agreement, because at the time I was feeling pretty pessimistic about our chances for a lot of reasons, the economy, the environment, we could go on. Now, a year later, I'm having a rethink. You know, I think it was the word abundance that stuck me. As I told you, I think it brought up this picture of more shoes in the closet, but there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Well, of course. I mean, abundance basically means having more of some resource than you absolutely need for survival. And it seems to me that's an important part of the resilience of any biological system, is that there's abundance in it, that there are more resources available than are necessary for the perpetuity of that system. Also, you know, it's our job at Mother Earth News and at Mother Earth Living and the other things we do, we feel like it's our job to broaden the audience, to bring the conversation about sustainability and about conservation to larger groups of people. And we've just found that talking about austerity and speaking constantly in terms of withholding resources from people makes it hard to begin that conversation. It's not that people aren't frugal or aren't willing to sacrifice or aren't willing to put up with a different kind of prosperity that doesn't consume as many resources. They're up for all of that. It's just that constantly couching the argument in terms of what people need to give up makes it hard for us to broaden the audience. And we think broadening the audience is a really important part of our mission.
Right, and I think, too, what our grandparents and great-grandparents might have seen as abundance has a different aspect to it, too. It's whether the table was full at Thanksgiving, whether the families were full. There's all sorts of things that we can have in abundance that don't have to bring the planet down with it.
For sure. I mean, abundance is dictated. I mean, the concept of abundance is based upon levels of consumption. You know, if we are moderate in our consumption, if we live simple lives, then abundance is much more easily achieved than it is if we are extremely consumptive and running around burning and eating and pillaging everything, pillaging nature, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, a modest, simple lifestyle makes abundance more accessible than it is if we don't live a modest, simple lifestyle. I mean, the other underlying quantitative condition on all this is human population, of course. You know, there are, what, over 7 billion people on the planet now. That's double what it was when I was born. It's a rate of population expansion that's completely unsustainable, and it's quite obvious, I think, to anyone who observes nature, anybody who works in agriculture as I do. It's perfectly obvious to everyone that we're going to have to stabilize the human population. If we're going to have to stabilize it, why not talk in terms of a truly sustainable human population, that is, a smaller population than is currently on the planet, a population that allows for ongoing abundance, natural resilience, the possibility of prosperity for all human beings, and the possibility of healthy, natural lifestyles for all forms of creatures. The only quantity in the equation necessary to achieve that goal that we refuse to talk seriously about is the human population. But in a world of 3 billion people, you know, it's possible, I don't think it's desirable, but it's possible everybody could drive an SUV.
Yes, except we can't do it with fossil fuels unless we come up with an answer for that. Now, we're electric vehicles, I suppose, solar-powered vehicles, we could do that. And that leads me to my next point, which is talking about beauty. That's part of the title. I stopped at North Bend on the way over here through Snoqualmie Pass. It's part of Washington State.
Yeah,
I've
been there.
Have you?
Place, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's this truck world there, and there was at least 500, maybe 1,000, I couldn't count them all, trucks all lined up, one, waiting to eat at their fast food restaurants. And I thought, okay, now this is the backbone behind a lot of the lives that we live that we never see. And there are other places that we never see, whether it's the tar sands or whether it's radioactive waste from nuclear plants. If we're going to have beauty, I think it has to be beautiful all through the process. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I certainly completely agree with your premise. I think that we should hold beauty as a standard for every activity we're in. I don't know that you can't extract fossil fuels in a beautiful way. I think you probably can. You know, levels of consumption are the backdrop for all of this. And of course, there are infinite numbers of ways that we could fuel transportation. We could generate electricity and store it in batteries. We could burn wood and create a gas from the burning of wood that could be combusted in engines. I mean, the list goes on and on. There are literally infinite ways of producing energy. The underlying question, though, is I think a question of values. If we hold beauty and abundance and fairness as fundamental values that we want to adhere to, it changes the way we make decisions about how we generate energy and how much of it we consume. It changes our decisions about how we run our businesses and where we get the raw materials and how we treat the people who supply those raw materials, how we treat the people who work for us. And I think that leads us in a direction toward a new set of human values that's more sustainable. I think that industrial society is really kind of a juvenile society. That's my fundamental belief, that industrial society is young and that it doesn't have grown-up values. And that, you know, traditional laissez-faire capitalists feel like capitalism has to work with no human intent involved at all. It has to function simply by the desire of people to become more prosperous, the availability of cheap natural resources which we can exploit, the availability of new natural resources which we can discover and exploit in inexpensive ways. It's the sort of very, what would one say, simplistic model. In the future, I think that really doesn't work at all. And that, in fact, value will have to be created through conscientiousness, through a mindful approach to businesses of all kinds, including the production and consumption of all forms of energy. And in that value system, the kind of wholesale environmental damage that's occurred in pursuit of fossil fuels just won't be palatable. People won't wish to consume fuels that are extracted in that kind of exploitative way. I think we're on our way to that new value system.
This is Radio Week of Shock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm with Brian Welch of Ogden Publications. And you talk about the Mother Earth News Fair community. Well, the Mother Earth News community. And you have a vision for that. I don't think you're doing this just for the money, Brian. I think you're doing this for some reasons. What is motivating you?
Wow. Fundamentally, I think I'm motivated in the way maybe most people are motivated. I really want to leave a better world behind. I really want to find ways of improving the world I live in. I think most people are motivated that way. You know, Alex, this may surprise you. Well, part of this may surprise you. So we're studied by big research agencies because we're a big enough magazine. The big advertisers want to know who our readers are. And these big syndicated research agencies, the most prominent one's called MRI. MRI measures all kinds of facets of our readers, including their political persuasion. And the Mother Earth News reader is about 95% more likely than the average American to describe themselves as very liberal. And they are 85% more likely than the average American to describe themselves as very conservative. Furthermore, because there's so many more self-described conservatives in North America than there are liberals, we have about three times as many very conservative people among our readers than we do very liberal people among our readers. Conscientiousness is not partisan. And one of the grand errors, one of the biggest mistakes made by the conservation movement all this time, has been to focus their energies on quote-unquote political liberals and to ignore the deep conscientiousness of political conservatives. And we try to open up the dialogue to people of every political persuasion by eliminating the tribal language and the partisan language from what we talk about, and just talk about in terms of what a person can do in their own lives to make the world a better place. We find huge audiences at both ends of the political spectrum for that particular message. And I find, you know, you asked about my own motivation, I find that deeply gratifying.
Well, conservation did begin, I would say, in America at least. Well, one of its roots is with Theodore Roosevelt, who made the Great Parks, and there have been conservatives who want to conserve.
Seems logical, doesn't it?
It does. So what's next for you? Are you going to do presentations at the show?
I'm giving a couple of talks. I just contributed, I'm going to talk about my own thinking. I'm working on a book which I'm tentatively calling Heroic Compassion, about the need for human mortality to create a sustainable world. I'm pointing out to people these days that if we cured cancer tomorrow, that we would have to start building another New York City every year to accommodate all the human beings that weren't dying of cancer that year, just to sort of put a real stamp on it. And when I was reading something about human lifespans expanding dramatically over the next few decades, and there's good scientific evidence that that's going to occur. But it struck me as obvious then that eventually we have to choose between something like immortality and reproduction. You can't have both. You can't have everybody living forever and reproducing biologically, right? And when I thought about it in that way, it occurred to me, well, if I had a choice between those two things, I would obviously choose to reproduce and to die. And once I made that conscious choice, it sort of liberated my mind. It made me a happier person. It gave me a whole new sense of a kind of heroic aspect to mortality. The sacrifice, the natural sacrifice of passing on and leaving room, not just for other people, but for all kinds of other living things. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that when I stand up on the stage tomorrow. And I'm going to join a panel discussion with my friends Lyle Estel and Albert Bates about a book we all contributed to that's coming out here in the next few months.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own home life in Topeka, Kansas, I believe it is?
Yeah, I live just outside of Lawrence, Kansas, on a 50-acre farm where my wife and I raise cattle and sheep and goats. We have a bunch of chickens and keep sheepdogs and a few other animals. We have donkeys who protect our sheep and goats from predators. And both of us have other careers besides the farming, and so that's sort of our avocation. My daily life, you know, I write in the morning, I go to the office during the day, and I come home and farm in the evening, usually.
Sounds like a busy life for sure. One other aspect I wanted to ask you about was there are a great number of Americans now who are feel like they're falling in their standards of living, and there are some who are just plain poor. There are millions of poor. There are millions of people on food stamps. And I could see a lot of solutions for those people in the Mother Earth News. There's a lot of things that you can do there cheap, that you can do with recycled materials, that you can do for yourself. Do you feel that that audience is also part of your readership and your mandate, if you want to say?
For sure. For sure. Well, there's a great American tradition of improving our standards of living through self-reliance. If you can make something for yourself, then you can afford a better thing. You know, you can raise your own standard of living through just your own bootstraps and your own energy level. And that's a big part of the history of Mother Earth News. It's been a part of our message from the very beginning, and it's a real important part of the message. Yeah, I think everybody interested in Mother Earth News is interested in self-reliance, and we find an improvement to our quality of life, not only through the resources that we create, but also through the engagement with doing for ourselves, which makes us healthier and happier and more satisfied on a daily basis, I think.
Right. We don't just want to be witnesses to our own lives and have someone else define, maybe through a corporation or the T-shirt we wear with the name brand or something like that, who we are. We want to define ourselves. And that's partly what you're talking about, building the world we want.
Yes, I think that's very true. Future generations are going to want us to leave that world behind. But furthermore, I think there's a sacred commerce between human beings and nature. We're part of nature, of course, but it's a sacred communion between us and the natural world that produces our food. We're engaged with that communion on a daily basis every time we consume anything. And the more intimately we become involved in that communion, I think the more satisfying it is on a psychological and spiritual level. I think people love creating their own food because it is a sacred communion and because there's something deeply and innately fulfilling about interacting on an intimate level with nature to produce what we eat.
And we talk about green jobs. We're sitting beside a building of green entrepreneurs here at the Mother Earth News Fair.
Yeah.
And just a wide variety of people. And I'm seeing a lot of people with families. And these people aren't fooling around like it's a hobby. There's a living being made here. And it's, I would say, an honest living.
I think capitalism is the most important ally conservation, conscientiousness, progressivism could have. And we make a big mistake when we reject the capitalist machinery as a whole, because the best energy, the best achievements in conservation and in sustainability over the past many decades have been achieved by private business people innovating for the purpose of creating successful, profitable businesses. And Mother Earth News is one of those businesses. Yes, and we're not solely motivated by the profit motive, but one of the ways in which we continue to do good in the world is by continuing to be profitable. And we can do more with the largest media brand about sustainability in the world because we've been consistently profitable and reinvested our profits in the business. And it could not have been achieved, in my opinion, in any other way.
What do you think? I'm seeing in some of the exhibits a longing for an agrarian past. You know, I just feel that when I look at some of the boards are carefully chosen. They're old barn boards, and some of the structures that I see remind me of old American farming. Is the past part of our future?
I think the past is not that far past. I think also that it's the nature of human learning that we keep track of the innovations we wish to retain and those we wish to reject. And I think in every generation there's been change, and every generation has chosen which of those changes it wants to keep and which of those changes it wishes to throw away. So being in touch with the past is very important. Say it's a meter against which we can measure our current lifestyles. I know that our readers value very deeply the traditional agrarian lifestyle that was lived close to nature, in which people knew exactly the source of their foods and of their livelihoods and understood the mechanisms of those livelihoods and the sources of their food. And so, you know, a lively, vital knowledge of what life was like in our agrarian past is very important to maintaining those critical connections, I think.
Well, and plus, people like Bailey, I believe it was, that wrote about how to grow in the 1910s, 1920s, no toxic pesticides. I mean, it had to be organic, and how to reuse the ashes from your wood stove when you were growing. All these sorts of things are still very useful knowledge now if you want to have clean food and be self-reliant.
And we, at points in history, live truly in harmony with nature in a way that could have persisted for at least until the planet ceased to be a good host for biology. And we're probably not living lives today that are truly sustainable. Modern industrial society is out of balance. I think there's an intuitive understanding that that's true. And so we look for examples of good balance, true sustainability in the past, and we find, I think, some good direction from that. Although I definitely caution people against being too nostalgic. You know, we live today in the least violent, most prosperous times in the history of our species. Fewer innocent people die of violence now than ever before in the history of our species by a significant measure. Fewer people are desperately poor. Fewer people are hungry. Human lifespans are longer. Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Natures, enumerates the evidence that shows all this to be abundantly true. And so I think it's very important to understand what we've gained and the power of the positive visions we've had in the past, in order that we don't throw away those gains. But that doesn't mean that everything about modern society is superior to the lifestyles we previously led. So I would caution people about uniformly endorsing this either as the best of times or as the worst of times.
Why do you think so many of us are fearful about the future?
Well, part of that is the news media, which only gains ratings and audience by reporting scary stuff, or not only, but that's certainly the best way. I mean, I was a newspaper publisher for many years, and the car wreck and the frightening headline were always much more compelling to create sales on the newsstand than stories about how good things were. So that's how the news media works, and that's part of it. Part of it may be just neurosis. You know, that people have a hard time acknowledging that they live in a very comfortable, relatively easy time compared with past times because they personally are struggling. And it doesn't make sense to them that life might have been harder for previous generations.
Which it was, with the Great Wars and the Great Depression. We just haven't gone through that tens of millions killed in a war during our lifetimes, I don't believe, at least not here in the West.
No, many of our previous chapters were truly horrific, and not that long ago, you know. The life on the North American frontier, when Native Americans and Europeans were battling for territory, was frightening and grotesque and horrific, and it's not all that long ago. But we tend to romanticize the past, perhaps for neurotic reasons, I'm not sure. So, you know, it's a tricky business, isn't it? Figuring out what we want our future to be like and correctly assessing what we've accomplished without being too self-congratulatory or indulging in hubris. Because, of course, there's a lot in the past that we could adopt today and improve society. And we should look for a future that's more sustainable and more humane and more prosperous than the age in which we live. I tell people that there are fewer poor people than ever. But I don't mean to excuse the fact at all that there are millions upon millions of terribly poor people across the globe. And there shouldn't be. We have the power to create some level of physical comfort and prosperity for everyone. And we should do that at the earliest possible opportunity. But previous generations' positive visions of prosperity and of peace have been realized by our generation. We also need to accept that that achievement has occurred and try to make sure we don't give up the ground we've gained.
That is a beautiful place to end, I think. We've been talking with Brian Welch, and you're with Ogden Publications. Do you own Ogden Publications? Are you CEO? What is
your
relationship?
I'm the chief executive, and it belongs to a group of shareholders. They're all members of one family, not my family, but they've been wonderful and supportive and made it possible for us to do this all these years.
Right. And are you going to keep going with Mother Earth News Fairs? Is that just...
I believe we'll have more every year for the next several years. They've been very popular, and they're, again, profitable. And so we're going to try to expand them across the country.
There's a big crowd inside the building today. Thank you so much for being with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Do I agree with everything Brian Welch or any of my guests say? Radio EcoShock is not a puppet show where guests express my own personal state of mind. It is a platform. It is your platform, supported by you, the listener, to hear the visionary voices, the real people who are doing it, before you make your own life choices. Thank you for listening and being part of Radio EcoShock. Find out how to support this program, please, at our website, ecoshock.org. And you can get tons of links for this show at our blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. If anything you hear makes you part of the solution, my job is done. Let's meet again next week. This is Vancouver's own Barney Bentall and the Legendary Hearts.